I'm Chris McAdoo, and this is Enjoyable Listen Time with Best Behavior, where we talk to people who make things and make things happen. And, with any luck, inspire you to do the same.
I don't have my headphones. I'm reading meters.
The meters look...
Meters are, yep.
Meters look clean. All right.
Yours is hotter because you're a loud talker.
That's right. That's why I'm on this side of the table.
That's right.
So everybody, welcome to Enjoyable Listen Time, episode 7, right?
I think so.
7. I am your indomitable, abominable. I'm your abominable host.
You're abominable.
Abominable host. Chris McAdoo.
Indomitably abominable.
Yes. And I appreciate everyone for joining us today, where Enjoyable Listen Time, we look for people who are making things and people who are making things happen. That's a pretty good, that's a poppy slogan.
I like it.
I feel like it. So today, we wanted to actually bring it in-house. I have been out and about for what seems like weeks and weeks and weeks now in business town.
Businessing,
talking to business people and doing business things, which is cool, which is very cool. But
keeps the lights on.
In the end, I am an artist and designer and creator way deep down in my guts. And we wanted to talk more design. Right?
Yeah.
So today
also keeps the lights on.
It also, yes, without the good work. So George Middlebrooks, who is the abominable, indomitable producer of Enjoyable Listen Time, is actually going to be the subject of today's interview. Hello, George.
Hello. Hi. Hey.
Wait, I was waiting for the applause. Yeah. We also have, we go.
Got an audience today. I think this is our first audience.
And across the table from us,
at least in the same room,
is Courtney Hendricks.
Giving us both the stink eye.
She runs the show at Best Behavior Creative Club, and essentially spends most of her time giving me or George the stink eye.
Yep.
Like, much deserved. So,
there she is.
But, so let's get things started. George spends a lot of time on the Best Behavior side of things as sort of our lead developer, designer, and kind of just keeps us on the front end of trying to do cool stuff.
I try.
Right? So, George, talk to me a little bit. A lot of people don't know this because a lot of people don't really know us except for, like, our moms. Courtney. Knows us. We went to school together back in the day. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up, George.
I grew up in Sevier County, Tennessee, just about, 20, 30 miles up the road from here. And in lovely Wares Valley, which is full of cabins and helicopter rentals, and I think that's about it now. But we met at what was Sevierville Middle in fifth grade.
Yeah,
and that I ended up there for a few years, and
we were in the baseball card club together.
That's right.
So for any of you nerds,
in the
out
heyday
there,
of the Bash Brothers,
oh dude. I haven't even heard that for a while. Well, hey, for all you weirdos and you nerds out there, that you can take solace in the fact that there were other weirdos and nerds.
That we were weirder and nerdier.
Yes, absolutely.
Everybody's got to have their thing.
Yes. So you grew up in Sevier County. You went to
Gallenberg Pittman High School.
There you go.
Go Highlanders.
Highlanders. That makes more sense.
Yeah. No, not Islanders.
That doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
Highlanders, because I don't really know why.
Yeah.
The marching band wore kilts.
Nice.
Which is why I was not in the marching band.
There were so many reasons you were not in the marching band.
Most of my friends were. Hey, guys.
You play all the instruments.
Yeah, it's true. I do play a lot of instruments, but none of them are marching band instruments.
Ah. We'll get into that. I want to talk about George and Music Town here in a little bit, but let's get next step.
I don't want to jump the gun.
Did you? I know there's an order to things. Right? Yeah.
You've got notes. You got an outline.
I do. So you went to where'd you go to college?
University of Tennessee. Yeah. I ended up here in Knoxville for UT. I went in thinking I was going to major in either architecture or drawing, something drawing related.
Yeah.
I learned about the agonizing apprenticeship process in architecture and internship, and how much that drags on, and how you're basically abused and underpaid. I mean, that's the convention, or at least what I was told when I was 18. And I thought, man, I want to get paid when I got out of school.
So
I'm going to major in draw. Oh, wait. And so, but I did, I sat down with the only advising appointment I ever had. I sat down with the advisor, and I don't remember her name because I only met with her that one time. She said, so really you want to get a job when you got out of school? I said, yeah, I guess.
It seems like a nice thing.
I was 18, 19 at the time. Said, yeah. She said, okay, you're going into the drawing track. If you take this one class in addition to like the basic drawing curriculum, history of graphic design, check it out, see what you think of graphic design. And that's a thing you can make a career out of. You don't have to decide for a year because you don't take any graphic design classes until your sophomore year. And I was like, okay, cool. Check it out. And I realized that graphic design was a thing that I loved and didn't know that I loved it. Like I had album covers and book covers and posters and stuff on my wall just because I liked the design of them. But it had never occurred to me that like that was a thing that appealed to me. And I'd always been like an art kid, art nerd, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I was actually also a design nerd, and I didn't even know it, and got super into it. And that was pretty much it. Like I stayed on that track, and I graduated in 4 years, and got a job right away, thankfully.
And here you are.
Paid with cash American dollars.
Man, I think that's how a lot of people, even today, how a lot of people come to graphic design.
Yeah.
Like as a profession.
You stumble into it.
I mean, I know that's how I grew up, kind of the same way.
Yeah.
Always, I was the art nerd.
Yeah.
You know, always drawing, always doing those kind of things. And when I went to school to study, I ended up getting the painting degree.
Yeah.
Right. But I was introduced, I want to say freshman year, to that sort of visual studies class.
Yeah.
And then second year was history of design and all that. And it's not even things that you realized were designed.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and when you're a 15-year-old kid and you're just an art nerd, you kind of look at stuff and it's like, man,
I like
that's
the
cool.
shape of those letters. I like the color, yeah. whatever. I'll put that on my wall. But yeah, not actually putting a name on it as a thing, as being designed as a thing, or the designer as the, you know, the person who thought it through and put those letters together.
And all of the things that kind of came before that.
Yeah.
Let's go deep nerd here for a second.
Let's do it.
Let's go deep nerd. It won't take long. I know it won't. Courtney just said it will not take long. So when you kind of got into the history of graphic design, and maybe a lot of you design nerds can relate to this as well, is who did you discover that, you know, as a designer that you really were sort of drawn to, or a group of designers, or
definitely the Swiss stuff.
Yeah. Like, I can tell.
Yeah. It's stuck. Yeah. I like limited palette.
Yeah.
Clean, balanced, high contrast type, and not a lot of adornment, not a lot of cruft.
Cruft. Wow.
With an F.
That is a big
word. It's a little word. With a big, yeah, it's a strong word.
Well, the Swiss, like
BS.
Yes.
Yeah. No BS design.
So clean.
Bauhaus also.
Oh yeah.
Constructivist kind of. But they all kind of have that same thread of like simple color, simple shape, yeah. simple type.
At that same time, I was going through, since I was kind of doing the painting and the learning about design at the same time, I had that duality of I loved Lester Beale.
Yeah.
Which you guys, everybody needs to go to the Google machine, right?
Yep.
Look up all these things if you don't. The Swiss style Bauhaus, Lester Beale.
Is it two L's?
Yeah, two L's, BEALL. Wonderful, a series of posters like around in the 30s. Just super cool stuff, good things to look at. But that, and then at the same time being influenced by fine artists like Jasper Johns, Robert Rauschenberg.
Two of my three favorites up there with Pollock.
There you go.
Johns, Rauschenberg, Pollock are my dudes, and Rothko. And also, like, I can see that there's a relation between, like, the favorite artists and also the favorite designers or design school or style. Like,
yeah.
It all kind of connects.
Well, and that was design before it had even been necessarily defined.
Yeah.
Like, as sort of that professional, like, I'm a designer.
Yeah.
You know, those guys were doing that. Courtney, who's
graphic arts.
Who are some of your...
Paula Scher.
Also great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of tough to be,
yeah. You can't get away from your first loves.
But, you know, like, the cool thing about design, I mean, we've talked on this, you know, on this podcast, and we talk all the time about clients, about how design serves a purpose,
mm-hmm.
right? So, and my personal thing is that design is artful, which is different from straight up art.
Yeah.
Right? Because it serves a purpose you know, beyond itself.
Kind of rides that line between craft and art.
Yeah. But
there's always that argument.
And that's a great argument to have. I love it. But
there's no winner.
I think that we're all winners, George.
We're all. That's
there
right.
You go. But I think that, like, our Paula Schers, our Sagmeisters, our you know, all those guys, they are a great, I mean, they're just a great, they're somebody that can do work that straddles that line effectively and pushes our profession, you know, if you're a designer, pushes it forward, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit, like, about that, because it is kind of tough when you're in, you know, bill paying mode, like,
to think of yourself as any sort of artist.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
And I'll also like to add, this is a good kind of segue into George has, I mean, once you get past, like, just you got family, you got people, you're right, you're taking care of people.
Yeah, yeah.
And so how do you keep that sort of spirit alive of trying to do the best work, doing those things, you know what I mean?
And not just cashing the check and whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's, I've just always had that thing in the back of my mind just telling me, just do whatever you're going to do, do it well, do it to the best of your ability.
Yeah.
And there's always that, you know, once every couple of years, there's going to be some job that just, once you get into it, you're not feeling it and you just kind of slog through it and you cash the check at the end and shake hands and part ways. And that's life, I guess. But I don't, you know, it's a rare project that I get into and I don't find something that I learn and get excited about just learning something new. And
right.
I think that's the thing that once I got into the design as a career, or really not even like in school, you know, we'd have assignments with a particular theme or concept or whatever, and you have to do a lot of research and educate yourself on a thing, and it broadens your horizons immediately. And so I think, like, even if it's something that that may seem uninteresting on the surface, you're still going to do a lot of research and you're still going to dig and educate yourself. And just as a naturally curious person, that's where I'm going to find interest in a project. And so that's going to make me want to research more and want to work harder and want to make something cool to represent what I've learned and just make myself happy, if nothing else.
No, I always dig that. Like, the thing that is kind of tough to understand in school a little bit until you get out is that as a designer or a developer or whatever it is that, you know, that how we are working, is it's in your best interest to learn about that industry.
Yeah. And I can't imagine not. And I'm sure there are designers out there who just kind of plug away and make things pretty.
Right.
And you can usually see it. I think it shows up in the end product if they're just, you know, if it's just like a design in a box kind of thing.
He just.
It doesn't work well.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't work well. It's there and it exists, but it's not really going to fulfill anybody.
Well, it becomes derivative of itself.
Yeah.
And especially, in a, I mean, you know, design, there are, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of us or whatever, but in essence, like, it's a small community.
Yeah.
So if you're in a oh, God. I just business talked. If you're in a mid-market town like Knoxville, but like if you're in a mid-sized town like Knoxville, especially, or there's other, I mean, you know, there's Knoxville, there's Charlotte, there's other, you know, all over the, you know, all over the world. But that community of designers and creatives is small.
Yeah.
And your work gets known one way or the other.
Yeah, yeah.
And it gets known, I think, pretty, it can get known pretty quickly.
Yeah. And yeah, if I'm going to be known for anything, I want to be known for
doing good,
having a good head on my shoulders and thinking through things. And I think I'm a friendly, pretty friendly person. And I like to
get also, carried away.
I know. I'm just blowing smoke. But I like working with people I like. Working with people, you know, you're not always going to hang out with your clients or your coworkers or whatever, but it's nice to work with somebody who you would want to, you know, who you're going to enjoy sitting down and having lunch or a drink with. And I like to think I'm that kind of person too, like easy to get along with during the project and after, and somebody you can call up with a problem if there's something wrong with your project or, you know, whatever, or come back for the next thing.
Well, okay. With that in mind.
And that goes beyond just style.
Right. Well, let's talk about, because design is the marriage of that style, right?
Mm-hmm.
And function.
Yep.
Right? I mean, like, so these things have to work. So with that in mind, if we're the mechanics for the car, kind of thinking about this, for folks out there who work with our side of the, you know, of the table.
Mm-hmm.
What are good things that somebody can kind of keep in mind? What's a good tip for somebody literally hiring a designer or a web developer or a content creator, you know, whatever, what would you tell somebody?
I think the conversation is more important than the portfolio. Like there's always going to be some like standout project. And I say this as somebody who hasn't updated my website in years. It's I think there's so much more impact to just sitting down and having a conversation and, you know, look through work and talk about work and stuff, but don't pin too much on like what their senior thesis looks like. Not to discount that, but that's going to be a good thing to show, you know, what you're about and what you do, but it's not everything.
Yeah.
Like you've got to be able to hold a conversation and also talk about your work lucidly and present it, you know, in a way that's going to help sell it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, and you've got the personality you've got, but I think it's an important thing to be able to come with to a project or to a client or to a job or whatever.
So that conversation, so to a prospective client, for somebody out there that is looking to hire a designer, like it's not just about how it looks.
Yeah. It's how you are, I think more than anything.
How it came to be.
And
really,
it goes back to rule number one. Don't be an asshole.
There it goes, PG-13. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Best behavior. I think it's PG.
I think so.
Maybe it's PG.
I think you can get you can probably get one asshole through on a PG.
There's two,
so,
though.
Now you there's two. Oh, really? Yep. So
but
now we're,
you know, this is a con, maybe a conversation.
Also, Chris
for
just
another
took his pants off, and that's really weird.
No. Now,
and Courtney's out.
It's a Tuesday party. So, but do you remember like movies from the 80s that had PG ratings?
Totally different.
Quite. There was a lot more cussing and
that bar was in a very different place.
Naked people.
Yeah.
Like just in pools.
Absolutely.
Rooms, living rooms,
gratuitous
lawns.
Boobage and terrible language by 12-year-olds. And
I am writing a note, gratuitous boobage.
Use that for something.
Great. I thought we were having a pretty good conversation up until this point, and now this is what's going to stick.
Well, now it's perfect.
Yeah.
Now it's perfect. All right. So we've been talking
a
lot.
Yeah, back to not being an asshole.
Anyway.
That's three.
Three. Ah. All right, so Let's bring it back around.
Yeah, I'll be editing this.
This is straight through. Straight through. Okay, so talk to me a little bit about now, as a creative person, as a creative professional,
yes.
Right? One of the most valuable things that I've sort of discovered for myself, as well as talking to other quote unquote creative professionals, is that you're not just doing one thing, right?
Yeah.
So in the beginning, we were talking a little bit about you may not have been playing clarinet, but you've played instruments your whole life.
Yeah.
Right? So tell us a little bit about your musical past and future and present.
I got an acoustic guitar that was way too big for me when I was 7 years old, and it sat in a closet until I was 14. And as most angsty 14-year-olds do, I wrote some sad, angry teenage songs with that guitar, which I really couldn't play. My buddy Clay taught me a couple of chords, and I kind of went from there because I really was just like barring a finger across the frets and just banging out sound that was terrible. I still kind of do that every now and then.
I was going to say, man, that sounds awesome.
But at least I know what I'm doing wrong. Yeah, yeah. Learn the rules before you break them. And yeah, so I've played. I gravitate toward electric guitars and loud electric guitars and heavily affected spacey sounds and whatnot. But yeah, I've played since I guess high school and got into home recording when I was 17 or 18 and got a 4-track and started doing all the home recording layering voices and guitars and stuff. And so that's kind of always been my thing on the side. Just kind of out of necessity, learning all the instruments that I can get my hands on.
Yeah.
And filling my house up with them.
Well, what are some of the...
I'd like to thank my wife for being very patient with, among other things, my instrument addiction. She's super cool with it because she has a shoe addiction and we balance each other out.
There
and
you
that's
go.
What keeps marriage happy.
Shoes and guitars.
Shoes and guitars.
So when what are some of the groups and people that you've been sort of involved with along the way?
I'd always recorded just under my own name. And I would say like self-released albums, but it was more like just dubbing tapes and CDs and handing them off to friends. Let's see, I guess at some point I decided to put a band name on it and, called it Stolen Sheep, and that's vague enough that it could be a band and it could be a single person. And so I recorded under that name for a few years, and some random band from like New Jersey emailed me and said, "Hey, I like your stuff. Do you guys want to set up a show in Knoxville? We're coming through on tour." And I was like, "Yeah, that sounds great." Thinking, "Oh, I need a band now." So I pulled my friends John and Jesse together, and they were gracious enough to learn my songs, and I paid them in beer and hugs, and
because
that's really all I'm good for. and so they've been playing with me for several years now, and Gray Comer joined us a few years later on drums. So there's that. That's always kind of bubbling. We haven't played out in a while because we got busy having kids and building studios and businesses and whatnot. But we're still a thing. I played with John Baker in Econopop for several years. I don't really know if that's still a band. That's been a long time since we played together. But I think it's one of those things that one day somebody's going to go, "Hey, let's get a show."
Yeah,
and I think that's the best way to have a band. Like every musical situation I've been in has been just super friendly and easygoing, and probably maybe too friendly and easygoing and democratic, because there's no, like, good bands usually have rulers,
right?
And like it's my band or it's John's band, but we're both like the easiest going dudes that there is, and so there's no taskmaster to keep the wheels on the track. But but that also means that there are no fist fights and no breakups, and we're just like,
right,
yeah, let's play together, cool.
Well, everybody at this point, too, is a grown-up.
Yeah, we're grown-ups. Like, we have absolutely no ambition. Like, we want to... if we play a show and we make $50, then awesome. And, you know, we'll play for the joy of playing. And I think that's kind of where it's at. That's where it's always been at for me.
I've been impressed by George and just your layer, like recording and musicking abilities. I'm in the show notes. I'm also going to put some links to stuff too. Definitely. He recreated Neil Young's After the Gold Rush.
Maybe I'll sell enough to buy a burrito next
month. Oh, sweet. Yeah. You'll owe me the burrito, though. The burrito.
Yeah, if we can make $20 and I can buy Chris lunch and also eat. It'd be more than I made off of music last year.
Well, I think that the music thing, you know, for so many, again, quote unquote creatives or whatever, like there's so many people that play.
Yeah.
There's so many people that create outside of your like computer job.
Right.
You know, which is a whole
There's usually that kind of contrasting thing too. Like,
yeah,
I sit in front of the computer all day until my eyes fry. I want to turn away and make a loud caveman noise on drums. Or turn the guitar up too loud and just play.
Yeah.
And, it does kind of break away from that. Like, I'm making clean design and doing something important.
This is Swiss and perfect.
Yeah, this is my Helvetica.
So that is sort of one side. And then the other kind of feeds into what has now become one of Knoxville's, like, primary coolest things, which is mountain biking.
Yeah, and that's my other thing. I pretty much have three things.
I think it's three pretty good things, right?
I have the work and the music and the bike. And, I mean, the family, that's always a thing.
Well, but, I think that's like the thing.
That's the thing.
And yeah, there's subcategories.
Yeah. I'm largely uninteresting aside from those three or four things.
Hey, tell me a little bit about, I want to, maybe potentially somebody around that is listening is familiar with the Downtown Downhill campaign a couple years ago.
Yeah,
George's has been intimately involved with the Appalachian Mountain Bike Club.
Yep.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
That came about, I guess, about 10 years ago now. Wow.
Right.
Knoxville's always had a nice little kind of tight-knit mountain biking community, and I sort of fell into it a little bit before AMBC became a thing, but it was just like 20 people on Wednesday night at Hall Ridge would ride a lap and come back and roast hot dogs and drink beer in the parking lot, and that group kind of slowly grew, and there was a little more interest developing some public land in South Knoxville. It started with Hasty Park. I don't know what the acreage is there. It's not big. It's like 80 acres or something like that. And there was a little group that built a couple of miles of trail there under the not supervision or I guess with the grace of the county. saying, yeah, do something with this, or the city. I guess that's in the city. But that it kind of quickly became evident that people really were interested in building trail and taking care of the land that was around there and making a nice place close to kind of central in Knoxville to ride. So you didn't have to go to Norris or Oak Ridge or out of town or something. Mm-hmm. And, so Appalachian Mountain Bike Club formed, and, its membership has grown really, really steadily in the last... I honestly have no idea how many local members we have, but it's a few hundred at least at this point. It's grown really steadily in the last 10 years, and that two-mile little stretch in Hasty Park has turned into about a 50-mile loop of trails all over South Knoxville on public and private land and greenways and dirt trails, and it's wonderful because it's free and it's usable for, you can take your bike on it, you can walk on it, you can take your dog, just whatever. It's a nice nice little gem in South Knox.
The gem on the hand of Thanos that is South Knoxville.
That's right.
So,
wow. Comic book reference. We are getting deep nerd.
Speaking of Thanos and powerful rings.
Yes.
I'm trying to, it didn't work.
No.
The metaphor did not translate.
Something, it's, something. Oh, Infinity
but
Gauntlet.
Courtney, the yeah. whole time, the whole time though, Courtney, I got the, side eye. Yeah,
I could feel. I didn't even look at her, but I could feel it.
Okay, all right. She's actually working. Yeah. We're the ones over here. We're just jabbering. She's like trying to get stuff done. But I did tell the good people a little bit about the Bell Helmet thing a couple of years ago. Like what you were. I mean, you helped a big way in bringing a lot of that to Knoxville. So
yeah, yes, good people. I started working with AMBC aside from just going out and building trails on the work days, designed the first website and logo and just kind of all the, it's just kind of, I've just kind of handled all the visual stuff and helped with kind of the marketing end and identity branding, aspect of AMBC. And I love kind of being that guy. Like I like to kind of keep it growing and just donate whatever time I can. And so a couple of years ago we had the opportunity to apply and became a finalist for a $100,000 Bell Helmet grant mm-hmm. to build a downhill trail. And every 2 years, I think they've always given like split up $100,000, between three different regions. And so you'd get like $30,000 to put toward trail improvement or build a new trail in a park or whatever. And that year they changed it up and they had this big bucket of money that they wanted to give to one locale. And so it was down to us and somewhere in, I think, Alabama and Minnesota were the finalists. And so we did this just big, and I can't possibly take credit for it all. I was part of a team.
Sure.
I just did the visual stuff. I was the pixel monkey. But we did this great online kind of blitz and did a bunch of social media and some cool videos and kind of helped get the word out about how great Knoxville is and how much we deserve that downhill trail. And as a result of all those efforts, we got that $100,000 grant and built the Devil's Racetrack Trail in South Knoxville, and it's awesome.
Come to Southie.
Come to Southie and ride it. Bring your bring your full face helmet and your pads. It is a double black diamond trail, and it's that means it can hurt you if you don't know what you're doing
on
it.
I'm slightly scared to walk on
it. Well, the nice thing about it is like it's part of a greater park. Like it's not just the only trail that's there, so you can go in and like every level of mountain biking skill has somewhere to ride.
Yeah.
Like if you are a kid on a push bike, there's a little trail for you there, and you can kind of work your way up and wind your way to the top, and it's not very technical trail to get to the top. And then once you get to the top of that hill, there are a couple of other trails you can get down and kind of work your way up to the Devil's Racetrack and practice your jumps and your rollers and you don't have to, nobody has to get hurt.
Nobody has to get hurt.
But you can if you try, I guess. I don't know what I'm saying there. I'm not really selling it very well. But
that's good. George
is awesome, trust me.
George is not the salesman of the of the group.
Well, I'm not a downhill rider. I'm just like, I like to keep my wheels on the ground. I like to go fast, but not like dangerous. I like to keep, you know, relatively upright, not flying off of
features.
Well,
I think that's, you know, Knoxville in this area, we talked about this a little bit with Aaron Donovan too, is just like all of this stuff that is happening that is so community driven.
Yeah.
That's positive for, you know, for this place. So I want to kind of wrap things up a little bit here. So George from...
I thought we just started.
Oh, yeah. We've got another hour and a half to go.
Courtney's rolling her eyes.
I know. It's like, oh.
Here comes George Middlebrooks, part three.
Yeah. So, George, from art nerd to music nerd to design nerd.
Bike nerd.
Let's kind of go out on a note here. Like, if it's 2017 and you're 22-year-old George Middlebrooks coming out of school, what would you tell that kid? What does kid need to know, man?
Yeah. Don't be in such a hurry to graduate. Go back and take out more loans if you have to, and take another year and take more printmaking classes and a couple of business classes.
That's not a bad
And I tell college kids that. I'll tell a student right now.
Hey, like, student,
don't be in such a rush to grow up and get out of school. Like, you, I didn't really grow up for several years after I was out of college. But I felt like I had. I was like, well, I'm out of school. Time to buckle down
and do a thing,
do the job. And I needed to have the job, and I needed to make the money, and that all worked out great. But I still did have that, like, as soon as I was out, I thought, man, I never took screen printing, and I should have spent more time in the letterpress shop, and I should have taken another painting class and another drawing, like, stuff that really fulfilled me. And just because I left, I kind of left that behind. So, yeah, well, maybe two more years. I would have done, I keep thinking of all the things I should have done. More anthropology, more painting, more drawing, more printing. Business class, definitely a business class. Yeah, I guess it's not. But, I don't know. I never took a business class, so I don't know how much. You took business, didn't you?
No.
I was thinking.
I did not. No, I started
okay,
a business.
Good.
No, I just went ahead and started
one. You just jumped out, yeah.
When I was done with school.
Well, yeah. I was always afraid to start a business because I thought, well, I don't have any training in business. But, I had a job for several years before I went out on my own. And I realized that I had observed enough business that I probably had soaked up enough to be able to put it to use. But just like technical, what are the technical aspects of starting and running a business? I thought, there's got to be some textbook for that, and there's probably not, because it sounds like a totally dumb thing now that I say it out loud.
How to
entrepreneurialize.
There are a lot of books.
Yeah, no, there are a lot of books.
Awful.
And I still don't read them.
They're so bad. Yeah. There's good ones, but there's bad ones too. So, thank you, George, for kind of taking the time today to talk to the people. There's a few things that I want people to take back with them. For potential clients and potential designers and people out there doing the things, conversation is more important than portfolio.
Sounds good.
I think that's probably one of the...
Oh, I said that. That's right.
Yeah, you said it, so... That sounds
smart.
Intelligent. But it comes back to those relationships. Like, do you trust someone? Do you have their best interests at heart? And do you feel like you can do the best work for them?
Yeah.
Within those confines. And then you also said, and this is you being from that Swiss school, learn the rules before you break them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of, for all you designers out there, there's a lot of deconstruction that can happen. But first, you got to learn how to build it.
And that's a good, that also applies to that conversation, Like, there are a lot of well-established designers who are would be terrible to sit down and have a conversation with. I won't name any names, but we've all heard of several of them. That you've got this bloated ego, and I think that there are you have to earn that, and I still don't think there's really any place for that, and I don't have a lot of patience for that. But I've known young designers who come out of school just thinking they're like just the hottest thing, and it's like you're just because you're the best designer in your class doesn't mean that you're gonna get anywhere.
Got a ways to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well. On that note,
don't break those rules. Don't break rule number one.
Don't be an.
Don't be an asshole.
Try it again.
Four.
Don't be an asshole. There we go.
Nice. High five.
That is it.
Woo! Courtney didn't pipe in on that.
I can't sing as well as you guys do.
I got to say that I did. I'll cut that in because I'm going to edit this thing tonight. We have a four-part harmony of us all.
We do.
Me and Chris and Courtney and Dana saying
we'll
that.
To...
And Courtney says she can't sing, but I didn't auto-tune a note.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us. This has been Talking Design with George Middlebrooks. all around good dude, designer and developer with Best Behavior. Courtney has been our live studio audience. Hey, Courtney. There you go. And I am Chris McAdoo, head court jester here at Best Behavior. And we appreciate your time, and we look forward to the next episode, which will be number 8.
Yes, because that's how numbers work.
They do. And cut.
All right.
We are bestbehavior.com.